Firstly, I must give you a disclaimer, because not everyone's in the military, so I need to let you know. 40 years so far, and we'll see. The next thing that's important is the expert problem. Yes, this is me, and I am playing. There's a bit of an issue in many fields asking the expert. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. You should all be aware of Dunning-Kruger effect. Basically, your confidence in a subject is not proportional to the amount you know about it. So if you start off and you get a little bit of knowledge, you end up in the, yes, I'm absolutely confident. So having attended Tom's introduction to wargaming, I can go home and I can put it on for the Ministry of Defence and everything will be fine. Of course, as you learn a little bit more, you realise that perhaps it's a bit more tricky. So at the start, it'll be, this is what Tom said. And then later on, it will go, well, I think we might have quite a few options, but I'm not at all confident. And then much later on, you will find the expert saying, it depends. Now, I'm a bit of an amateur photographer, and I go to these photography classes, and you'd have this amazing guy with this fantastic camera, and he'd take these incredible pictures. And I'd go, what setting should I have on my camera? And he'd go, it depends. And I'm thinking, that's utterly useless. So I'm going to try and avoid saying it depends. I will go, you should do this. Okay? And what I'm talking about is the 90% of the time, 80% of the time, it would be right. Because if I don't, you won't really know what to do. Of course, the really bright guys will be going, oh, hang on a minute, there might be an exception. But I'm used to dealing with soldiers. So if I said, well, there's an exception, the soldier would go, oh, I'm the exception. We don't want that. This is an introductory course, so I'm going to tell you quite clearly what to do. Behind that, there will be all sorts of complex explanations and dependencies, because I reckon I'm kind of round about this area here, okay? Although me saying that, of course, is a symptom of an expert, because they tend to undervalue themselves. So therefore, I must be up here. But before I tie myself in knots, let's get on with what we're talking about. The point is, I want to try and give you clear stairs. Okay, and not complicate it too much. If you start asking me questions, then we could end up in a rabbit hole quite quickly, which is good. So, how do we get better at something?
Practice.
Okay. There's an old joke. There's a tourist in New York. Have we got any Americans here? Anyone from New York? Excellent. So, a tourist goes up to a New Yorker and says, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? And the New Yorker says, practice. Because most New Yorkers are assholes. Practice. It's really important. Okay, so let's talk about the British Army's collective training system, CAST, Command and Staff Training. It's the most accessible system that we have of our three principal systems. Constructive, virtual, and live. This is the constructive system. Okay, now what are the characteristics of command and staff training? Well, it's expensive. It's not very expensive. We bought it quite a long time ago and only cost about 20 million. It is a complex computer system. It's a complex computer system connected to the British Army's command and control system, Bowman. And if anyone is here from the British Army, that's complex. So we don't have many of them. But we do have about 100 units to train. So under the new planning guidelines for steady state training, if you're in the reaction force, you'll get to go to cast twice in 3 years. And if you're like the rest of us, the adaptable force, then you might go once in 3 years. My wife sang at Carnegie Hall. She didn't get there by having a bit of a sing-song once every 3 years. Our principal training system has no value for training. Because under no possible way of thinking is once or twice in 3 years practice. The system itself is extremely good at assessment. Sometimes some units use it kind of twice in a row, so they get a week of practice before they use it. So it's not a complete disaster, but it doesn't give you practice. It's great for assessing you before you go out to Afghanistan or whatever. So what are we going to do? Well, you're here because I think you ought to be wargaming. And why do we want to wargame? It's to practice decision making. Okay? The big thing about practicing decision making is you need to do it against a real thinking enemy. I remember talking to the Corps commander who'd been playing Doom with his son. And I said to him, "What's it like playing Doom?" And he goes, "Well, it's a bit silly." I said, "What is it like playing Doom against your son?" And he goes, "Oh my God, it's a completely different game." That's the point. Nothing focuses the mind quite as well as having a live thinking enemy. And the purpose is to gain insights. It's not to win or lose. And in fact, the person who learns the most is probably the loser. It's to gain understanding and insights. Now, the guy who started the process off best is General von Moltke. And he had an established process for looking at this. You would take the team off-site, away from their normal work, and you would conduct a TEUT, a tactical exercise without troops. Okay? So you get all the officers together and you'd consider a tactical problem. And the way he would approach that is he would say, "Who's the most junior? Who do we think's the youngest in here?" "I don't know, who's the youngest? I'm looking around. Anyone volunteer to be the youngest?" There we go. So he'd ask the youngest person, he'd ask the most junior officer their opinion. Now, of course, the junior officer is perfectly happy to offer his opinion because he's the most junior. It doesn't matter. He has nothing to lose. So he would say, "Faced with these circumstances, I would do this." He would then ask the next most junior. And now we have a dilemma, because the next person has either got to agree with the most junior, thereby showing he's at least as intelligent, or disagree. And of course, if he's going to disagree in front of everyone else, he's going to have to provide reasons why he's going to disagree. And immediately, everyone in the group is thinking, "Oh my God, it's going to come to me, and I'm going to have to either add to what's been said before, or be brave and go, no, they've covered it all." And people then start considering the problem. And at the end of that discussion, he would go, "Right, we've now got a clear idea of the options that we can do, and we've come more or less to some thoughts about the best way of doing it. Now, split the team in half. In half. With the most senior guy and the next most senior guy on either side of the groups. Because we want the two sides to be intellectually equal, to have the same amount of experience. It doesn't matter what the force ratios are in the fighting. What we want is the two sides to be thinking equally. And of course, what that means is you've come up with a plan, you're really confident, and then you look at the other end of the room, you look at the other end of the field, and of course you realize that the guy at the other end has thought about it a lot as well. So the system makes you think. And he would do a very simple game. You have the initiative, what are you going to do? He'd walk over to the other group. You have, this is what you've seen. What's your response? And he'd go back and forth like that. Very, very simply. And I will reflect that in the first game. And then, as part of that process, a lot of assumptions would have been made. I can move my cavalry from their barracks here to this location here in 4 hours. Well, what you would do afterwards is test those assumptions. Call the unit out. Make them march that distance. Can you do it in 4 hours? And validate the assumptions that were part of the game. And then finally, they would get the staff to write up the game as if it was orders for a real operation. And then they put it on the shelf so that if anything remotely similar happened, the orders were there and they were ready. And of course, the implication from that is you're dealing with real circumstances. This isn't Fantasia versus Redland. This is Russia versus Estonia. Because what's the point of doing it with fantasy made-up stuff? There's plenty of point of doing it with fantasy made-up stuff under certain circumstances, but not for military training. Now, when we talk about war games cover a broad spectrum. There is no single game that's the answer to everything. And I'm going to show you a whole pile of games, and you're going to go, oh my God, where do I start? The point is, we need to determine what we're trying to achieve. So at this end of our spectrum, we are looking to maximize creativity, understanding, and original thought. I am a CO of an infantry battalion, and I have been mechanized. What that means is I receive the wretched refuse of Afghanistan, all those Mastiff vehicles, all those Jackal vehicles that are perfectly suited for a dry and hot environment in Afghanistan, and I've been invited to re-equip my unit with them in Scotland. So what am I trying to do? I'm trying to understand how the hell I'm going to get them to work properly and have a concept of how I'm going to fight with them. Now, at the other end, we are looking at rigor and analytical precision. We are looking at trying to persuade the government that we ought to buy something. And feelings and creativity and original thought will not get you money out of the treasury, most of the time. You need to make sure that you have numbers to support your proposal. Because of course, in the world of budgeting, if my spreadsheet's bigger than your spreadsheet, I win. And all the way through, these games have the maximum creativity, all the way to a computer-assisted analytical war game. There are different games for different purposes. These games, you can cover more or less anything, grey zone conflict, cyber, things like this. When you get to this end, of course, and your analytical precision, you're looking at what happens if I make this helicopter a little bit better. So why has wargaming suddenly increased in importance? And it has done over the last 4 or 5 years. Well, the biggest reason is thanks to this guy. This is Secretary Bob Work. There's a name to conjure with. He wrote to everybody in defense, literally everyone, including the Coast Guard, saying the US advantage of high technology, which followed on from the US advantage of nuclear weapons, is being eroded. India, China, to a certain extent, the Russians. The difference between US technology and their technology is much less than it was before. And part of the advantage that the US has is what they call the offset, the fact that they are so much in advance of everyone else. And what he's talking about is a third offset strategy. And the intention is to get people being creative, being innovative. And he firmly believed that wargaming was the way to do it. And not only that, he put quite a lot of money behind it. As a result, there's a huge impetus behind wargaming. That impetus has survived him leaving. And we've got a new Deputy Secretary of Defense in the state, because the threats that we are facing today are not the traditional threats that we used to face. And therefore, we need to have innovation. Now, people have said to me, what does innovation look like? You know, we talk about innovation and wargaming. You know, give me an example. Well, this is my favorite example. This is the class of 1927. Over here, we have a little piece of paper from the Bundesarchive, which lists the directing staff and the students who took part in a war game. The Germans didn't like calling it a war game. They called it a planning game, Planspiel, okay? So it's a couple of majors, there's a whole load of captains, and there's a young lieutenant in the Navy at the bottom. You might recognize some of these names. By the end of World War II, every single person on that list was a field marshal except for two. One of them was Karl Dönitz, because of course he was the guy in charge. In fact, he was the leader at the end. And the other guy was Guderian, because Guderian was a bit of an arse and people didn't like him. That's all very well, but someone said to me once, but those are Hitler's cronies. And I point out, that's not true. I don't think they're Hitler's cronies because everyone with an asterisk after their name has been executed by Hitler or sacked by Hitler for disagreeing with him, number one. Number two, it's the class of 1927. Hitler was jailed for treason in 1924. He was only let out in November 26 and was forbidden from speaking in public. This is not Hitler's cronies. This is the German army being professional under the limitations of the Treaty of Versailles. The Treaty of Versailles limited what the German army could do. It limited the size of the German army. Anyone know how big the German army was allowed to be?
100,000.
It limited naval stuff. No submarines. And no tanks. These guys invented Blitzkrieg without any tanks. Guderian, in his autobiography, said it was humiliating. They had to drive around in cars, automobiles. And they had little wooden frames over them, covered in canvas, so they looked a bit like a tank. And school children would come up with their pencils and poke holes in the armour. Humiliating or not, the German army defeated the massed armies of Western Europe in 41 days. And we had more tanks than they did. Okay? However, I mean, that's pretty compelling. But, you know, there's always some smart ass at the staff college. So, let's come up with a better example, a more strategic example. Down in the Great Hall, where you got your badge, there's a pile of advertisements for a book called A Game of Birds and Wolves. All about this. We're losing the Battle of the Atlantic, and Churchill said, work out what the U-boats are doing and work out a way to defeat them. The Navy's idea was to send a naval commander who had tuberculosis and was not allowed to go to sea. And they gave him a load of wrens. And the girls' defining characteristics was that they were good at maths and they were rubbish at typing. Because if they were any good at typing, they'd have gone and worked somewhere else. And they weren't that good at maths because they'd be at Bletchley Park by now. So he took those girls and came up with a game to understand how U-boats worked. And he did it. And that game, he was able to persuade the admiral to change the way U-boats were thought of and to come up with counters to the U-boat tactics. And here we have Gilbert Roberts. And here we have the girls practicing with the game. So the naval officers sat behind a screen. They had 2 minutes to make a decision. Beep, the buzzer would sound. And they would write what they were going to do on a little piece of paper. They'd post it in this little post box, and then they sit down and wait. The girls would take those little slips of paper and plot the tracks on the floor. The friendly force tracks are in white. The submarine tracks are in brown on a brown floor. And when they look through the little peephole, it has a bit of nylon stocking in front, so you get a brown filter, so you can't see where the U-boats are. The girls are pointing out where your ship is because you have limited situational awareness at night when the U-boats are attacking. This game was used to train virtually all the escort commanders, including Prince Philip, and was incredibly successful. To the extent that when the German Navy manufactured acoustic homing torpedoes, they sent out a very large wolf pack to totally destroy one of the convoys. They sank four of the escorts very quickly, one after the other. But the escort commanders, having played the game, realized something odd was happening. That the German submarines were not operating in the way that we would normally do. And they radioed back to the girls. After all, some of them were engaged to the girls. The best one at thinking of how the Germans operated was actually 17 years old. So I'm using the word girls deliberately and not with a modern view of downgrading their position. I don't intend to offer any offense. And I use the word girls for a reason. Quite a few of them got engaged to, of course, the dashing escort commanders. This social aspect helped enormously because they had no compunction with communicating back the strange things that the Germans were doing. They then stayed up all night working out what it might be. And by the following morning, had a valid tactic to defeat the acoustic homing torpedoes. And no further ships were sunk. While the convoy was still crossing the Atlantic. And the reason, of course, you've never heard of it, Western Approaches Tactical Unit, is because it remained classified after the war, a bit like Bletchley Park. Fantastic story, incredible women. I recommend you get the book when it comes out. If we look at an Israeli perspective, they do wargaming a lot because the intention is to create an adaptive culture. So the intention is to learn rather than win. So if you're taking part in a war game or a training exercise and you're not defeated at least half the time, then your training's not hard enough. You need to fail. You either win or you learn. You need to be surprised. Surprise, very important. You thought you were doing an exercise about this. Halfway through, it changes fundamentally. You need to be mentally challenged. You need to be given difficult problems to solve. Because the Israelis are very concerned that people understand that failure doesn't mean defeat. You need to learn from it, you need to recover from it, and then you need to be able to fight back. This is very important with regard to the fallout from the Chilcot inquiry. When we went to Iraq, a number of mistakes were made at the highest level because the army was doing its planning and making assumptions about what the government was going to do. And the government was making plans based on what it thought the military said they could do. And the decision-making process was flawed, and the consequences of the actions and the second and third and fourth order consequences were flawed. So if we are to move forward, we need to be able to demonstrate to government that we're taking these into account. It can't be more of the same. And the Vice Chief of Defense Staff believed that wargaming is one of the tools we could use in order to address some of these weaknesses. Another reason why I think we ought to be wargaming is because the Chinese think it's a really good idea. The Chinese appreciate that they lack combat experience. So how do they get that experience when they're not fighting a war? They believe that wargaming is the way to do it. This general here is now a full general following up on this. I've lectured in China. I gave 9 lectures. 8 of them were on computer simulation. I got maybe 20 people turn up to my lectures. I gave 1 lecture, 1, on manual wargaming. I got moved to the gymnasium. 250 military students at the National University of Defense Technology. Okay, how do we deal with hybrid warfare? What is hybrid warfare? You know, there's all sorts of words that get used a lot. Effects-based, non-kinetic, hearts and minds, gray zone, shaping influence, and it involves religion, training, morale, belief, whatever. You know, what is this thing, hybrid warfare? Well, we had a NATO conference on it. 26 people turned up, 26 nations. We could not agree. We literally don't know what we're talking about, by definition. It's a kind of a problem. And it's something we need to get a handle on. We might not get a handle on it all, but if we can get a handle on bits of it, we need to do that. And actually, wargaming can help. Now, people have said to me, what about computer games? You can't deal with new ideas. If it's not programmed in the computer, you can't do it. When you reach the edge of the play box, it's the end of the universe. It can only do simple rule-based behaviors. I'll expand on that this afternoon. What about AI? Come on, you know, Elon Musk's AI beats the professionals. You may remember that. It's happened loads of times. The best player in the world at a free-form computer game was beaten by the AI. Wow. They left the AI in the corner and said, you can play against it if you want. There's 50 prizes if you beat the AI. Every prize was won by lunchtime. Because the best person in the world knows what he's supposed to do, and the AI knows how to beat that. Other people come along and they go, I'll try this. It's a really stupid thing to do. And the AI goes, wibble. I don't know what to do with it. It's completely beyond my comprehension because I'm used to playing the best. Now, of course, the AI could learn. All it would have to do is play against you. And you. And you. And you. And probably on a Monday morning before you'd had any coffee, and on a Friday afternoon because you're a completely different person then. Yeah. Has anyone seen those motivational posters produced by AI? Then again, perhaps the AI is right. So, why do we want a war game? It's to gain an understanding of the problem. Fundamentally, it's to understand a problem. And within that, it's to practice decision making. It's to appreciate risk. Nothing in life is certain. Absolutely nothing, particularly planning for this place. We need games to exploit imagination. We need to understand competition and adversarial thinking. Too many of our plans are made in isolation and don't take into account what the enemy would do if we tried something. And another reason is it's a very quick way to learn about the people that you're going to have to work with and rely on in future. Who's the risk taker? Who's the detail person? A war game will tell you that very quickly. And believe you me, you will be defeated. And you will learn from your defeat. So, I want to leave you with a final anecdote. And it's about Original Thought and how it happened. And about computer simulation and all of that. And you're kind of wondering why I've got a picture of a bridge in southern Belgium. I used to be a rock climbing instructor before I knackered my shoulders. And we used to go every year to southern Belgium and put on an adventure training camp. So the soldiers would come down for a few days and they'd go canoeing, they'd go hiking, and they'd go rock climbing with me. So our camp was there and then the soldiers would appear. Anyway, one evening, a Belgian officer turned up in the camp and he said, "Hi guys, I've got a problem. I've got a platoon of guys from our equivalent of Sandhurst who are on their final exercise. And the problem I've got is two of my instructors are ill. So there's only me and another guy. And these chaps are really good. And we haven't been able to surprise them. Would you help?" Well, some decisions don't take very long, do they? So we went, oh, really? Are you going to provide the guns and ammo? Yes, brilliant. So they were camped at the bottom on this field here. Okay? And we thought, we're all rock climbing instructors. Let's look at the railway timetable, shall we? Oh, there aren't any trains. So what we'll do is we'll get our ropes and stuff and we'll run along the railway track and we'll tie ourselves onto the fence and then we'll abseil down in a James Bond styly and then they'll be surprised. Great. So that's what we did. So we're there, it's really dark and tied on and we're all ready to go and the sky lit up with explosions. And I slipped. And I'm now whizzing down the rope going, whoa. I went straight down. And at the bottom was an M113 personnel carrier. And the hatch was open. And I went straight through the hatch into the vehicle. They were surprised. I was surprised. Fortunately, I was able to get myself unentangled and leap out and run like hell before they beat me up. What had happened is, they dismounted the heavy machine guns off the top of their personnel carriers and they carried them up the top of the hill and they were looking down the railway track. So if we'd attacked them for real, we'd have been chopped to pieces. And I remember thinking to myself, in the British Army, we would never have thought of that because none of our vehicles with heavy machine guns on the top, have the tripods for the machine guns. So we're conditioned by our experience not to think of taking the machine guns off and putting them somewhere else. And then I thought, but hang on a minute, if I was fighting in an urban environment, the ability to take the heavy machine gun off the vehicle and mount it somewhere else, like on the fourth floor, might be a really good idea. But of course, we just wouldn't think of that because we don't have those tripods. And then I thought, when I play computer games, I can't take the tripod off. I rush to the heavy machine gun. I do the machine gunny bit. And of course, the computer has the bad guy just where I can't point the gun. And I suddenly realize I don't think about moving the gun. And therefore, the game is programming us. So that's why we want to do wargaming.